Hello and welcome to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. This week with me, Jane Shields.
The Minister for Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, Senator Conroy.
The government's ISP filtering policy is one component of the government's comprehensive $125.8 million cyber safety plan. This plan contains a comprehensive set of measures to combat online threats and help parents and educators protect children from inappropriate material.
By the end of this month, the federal government is due to start a live trial of its controversial mandatory internet filter. Called a clean feed filter, it's intended to increase online safety by blocking child pornography sites and any other material the government considers inappropriate. But there's mounting opposition to the plan, coming from the Greens, the online advocacy group GetUp, and the recently formed Australian Sex Party. And while there is no argument that child pornography is appalling, there's concern about increased government control over the types of sites adults can legally access online, including pornography. Today on Rear Vision, we're taking a step back from the debate over what should or shouldn't be online, to look at the origins of modern pornography and the way it's been regulated by governments. Has pornography always been around? And if so, where did it begin? In New York, the founder of the Freedom of Expression Policy Project is Marjorie Hines. She's a civil liberties lawyer and has written on the history of pornography censorship.
You look at Western history, I think the same is true of Asian cultures. You see pornographic images and descriptions of human sexual activity very early in the ancient civilization. And one of the things we find when we begin to do research on the Western European tradition is that it wasn't until many centuries later that the mainstream culture began to view these images as problematic. So, for example, the scholar Walter Kendrick, who wrote a book called The Secret Museum, talks about how when archaeologists began to excavate around places like Pompeii in Italy, which had been buried under volcanic ash, and discovering well-preserved frescoes and sculptures from ancient Rome, they found some highly explicit depictions of sexual organs and sexual conduct and people enjoying themselves. And this didn't seem to be a problem for the Romans in terms of public representations of this aspect of human life. They didn't seem to be concerned that children would see it. But by the time the archaeologists, and we're talking now 18th, 19th century, were discovering this, we had a very different mainstream morality and much more concerns about depictions of sexual conduct not being in the public sphere. So when these artifacts began to be discovered, they were put in a secret museum.
Only wealthy, educated males were allowed to see inside the secret museum. The erotic paintings and graphic sexual sculptures were considered too dangerous to be seen by women, children, or the poor. But it wasn't only the Greeks and Romans who dabbled in explicit sexual imagery. 12th century religious texts produced in monasteries have also been found to contain pornographic drawings, like priests with erections, masturbating nuns, and sexual couplings of clergy with demons and animals. At the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Catherine Lumby is director of the Journalism and Research Centre and co-author of The Porn Report.
If we look at illuminated manuscripts, which were religious texts, there's this phenomenon called marginalia, which are some of which are very sexually explicit drawings of nuns and priests doing all sorts of things, sometimes with animals involved. And that's quite shocking to people, you know, in the modern era. But, you know, there are certainly art historians who study this. And the meanings of the marginalia is still unclear. You know, perhaps it was a kind of a warning, you know, and a sort of intimation of hell. And if we look at Eastern culture, of course, there are many sexually explicit images which also served a religious purpose.
We really don't know why there were those explicit images accompanying those texts.
Well, there's a long debate in art history about that. And, you know, so certainly it's interesting to see that sexually explicit material sometimes had a religious function. And so sexually explicit images can have educational purposes, they can be religious, they can be considered art. So just because something's sexually explicit doesn't necessarily mean it's understood as pornography by the producer or the viewer.
There are also examples of political pornography. During the French Revolution, for instance, Peddlers on the streets of Paris sold drawings of Marie Antoinette in subversive sexual activities, like incest and bestiality. And in the 1650s, pornographic literature emerged, with themes of lesbianism, sodomy, seduction, and sadism. But what we understand as pornography emerged during the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution.
When you had early pornographic works, 18th century classic like Fanny Hill, most of the population is not literate. The literate classes, the more educated classes, the males at least, collected Fanny Hill. And, of course, they didn't think it would corrupt them. But as literacy develops, and in the United States, as working youth, male and female, start congregating in cities for employment, as immigrants start coming to the United States, and you have working people reading detective magazines, reading romance novels, this is when the opinion makers, the ruling classes, begin to want to establish legal controls.
Western governments started to make laws to control the production and distribution of pornography, and campaigns to eradicate social vice began. In the United Kingdom in 1857, the Obscene Publications Act was passed, and similar laws in the United States started to prohibit and criminalise what was generally described as obscene material. Professor Joseph Slade of Ohio University is author of a 3-volume reference guide on pornography and sexual representation.
Pornography is located on a kind of sliding scale. It's somewhere between erotica on the one hand, which is a more acceptable kind of expression, and obscenity on the other hand, which is not an acceptable form of expression. We commonly define obscenity as appealing to prurient interest, and no one knows quite what that means, but everybody seems to know it when they see it. It's nasty, it's demeaning, it's inhuman somehow. But pornography occupies a domain somewhat removed from that and closer to what we think of as erotica. Now, erotica for most people is sort of socially acceptable sexual stimulation. It's the sort of thing that allows us to put a volume of nude photographs that are tastefully done on our coffee tables for, you know, sort of semi-public display. Generally, pornography comes out of obscenity and moves toward erotica as people accept it. Generally speaking, there are differences, and we've even tried to codify them in law, but they're still very slippery sort of terms.
The obscenity laws in England and America offered no legally enforceable definition of obscenity, so it was left up to the discretion of the courts to identify what was obscene and could therefore be prosecuted under these laws. It was in 1868 that the landmark Regina Hicklin case was heard in the English court.
It was important because the court in that case, the High Court in Britain, had to answer for the first time the question of what was meant by obscenity in the Obscene Publications Act. And the material in question was an anti-clerical pamphlet, which was an attack on the allegedly lascivious practices or language or that was used and encouraged in the course of the church confessional. What the court said in Hicklin was, what is obscene is material that would tend to deprave or corrupt the minds of those who are open to such immoral influences and into whose hands a publication like this might fall. So it was a two-part definition. First, it turned on who was vulnerable to depraving and corrupting influences, and that really meant women, working class men, anybody who was not an educated upper-class male in Britain. What did they specifically mean by depraved and corrupted? Thinking about sex, getting sexually aroused, and jerking off. So the first part of the Hicklin standard is, will it deprave and corrupt young people, primarily? And the second part of the standard is, will the material fall into their hands? Is it cheap enough for them to be able to buy or acquire? If you've got a 200-pound volume of Fanny Hill, that's not going to be a concern because it's not going to be likely to fall into the hands of those who would be depraved and corrupted.
This rather broad test of who was vulnerable was picked up by anti-vice movements to justify campaigns against obscenity.
Class very much enters into it, and the assumption always was that if you were well-educated, if you were upper class, you could consume erotica, consume pornography with no ill effects. And there's a sort of built-in prejudice against what we assume to be sort of uneducated minds. And this was the way Anthony Comstock sort of characterized the danger. He thought that the real problem was that what he called immature minds might stumble across material like this. And of course, he launched these campaigns to stamp it out. And what he meant by immature minds were the minds of children, the minds of immigrants, because they were always suspicious, and to him they were always lower class, and women who were thought to be weaker, so that they had to be protected.
Anthony Comstock was a leader of the anti-vice campaigns of the late 19th century in the United States.
He was initially hired by a group called the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, a group of upstanding New York businessmen and other gentlemen who were interested in protecting the working class youth of the city from the terrible scourge of cheap and sexually arousing literature. And Comstock persuaded the U.S. Congress to vastly expand the existing obscenity laws in the U.S. to cover anything, really, that was considered sexually arousing or improper, including birth control information and devices, so that Comstock, who became an authorized inspector and prosecutor for both the state of New York and the United States government, with the authority to arrest people, to seize materials, and as time went on, a lot of literature and art also became subject to Comstock's idea of what was obscene. And the courts generally went along because they were following this very restrictive and broad Hicklin standard.
This obscenity test remained the standard legal definition for criminal obscenity for almost 100 years and has shaped social responses to sexual expression and pornography.
It's not until 1957 in the U.S. that the Supreme Court finally addresses the issue and finally says the Hicklin standard is not consistent with the First Amendment. We cannot reduce the adult population to reading only what is considered fit for children. And that leaves two problems. One is the problem of, okay, now that we're not going to have an obscenity test, a dividing line between what society is going to allow in the terms of sexual speech and what it is going to prohibit. Now that we're not going to use the Hicklin standard anymore, what are we going to use? Because we are not prepared to say anything goes. We're not prepared to say any pornography, any sex education, no matter how explicit, should be allowed. That might be the more rational answer, but it's not an answer that the U.S. Supreme Court was ready to give in 1957, and it still isn't. And I think the same is true of England and probably and certainly Australia. So question one, how are we going to define what's prohibited for adults? And question two is, how are we going to deal with the special continuing concern about children and adolescents and their socialization and their sexual development and the widespread feeling that, at the very least, pornography is not appropriate for them and perhaps it's even harmful? So two separate dilemmas that are still with us.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and online. Today, we're talking about the history and regulation of pornography. The 60s and 70s were decades of major social change, and as the sexual revolution broke down taboos around sex, government controls over pornography were relaxed. Australian Minister for Customs, the late Don Chipp, abolished censoring of books and brought in a new R rating that opened the way for more sexually explicit films to be screened in cinemas.
72, with the Whitlam government coming to power, you had a huge movement of social, political and cultural change. And a lot of the people on the left were, you know, rabidly against censorship in those days. And there was this period through the 70s where you had movies like Deep Throat, which was one of the first pornographic movies with a narrative, that couples went to see. They would go to the cinema to see sexually explicit material. But interestingly then, by the early 80s, you have the rise of anti-porn feminism. I mean, not all feminists are against pornography, or all pornography, I should say, but there's certainly a hardcore in the feminist movement who equate pornography with the rape of women, with a kind of hate speech. And so what you then see is some people on the left moving into an alliance really with often the conservative right, and they come together when videos are released to really lobby for very strict censorship laws. And from 1984 on, X-rated videos, which is non-violent sexually explicit material, remains banned in all Australian states for sale or rental. And of course there's a black market in it, but so really you have this window where there's a lot more license around sexually explicit material, and then that shuts down in the early 80s.
The conservative backlash of the 1980s had its origins in the feminist debates of the previous decade.
So this becomes a very, very divisive issue, and you have the sex-positive feminists and the sex-negative feminists battling each other out to the point where the two leading promoters of the anti-pornography viewpoint in the U.S., Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, are going around the United States testifying before various city councils and state legislatures with proposed model legislation to outlaw pornography, to expand existing obscenity laws well beyond the boundaries that the Supreme Court had articulated, and develop a new theory of censorship of sexual material that turned not on offensiveness, but on whether the material depicted or described the sexual subordination of women.
Under the Reagan administration, his anti-pornography attorney general, Edward Meese, began an inquiry into the harms of pornography.
You had this very highly charged, highly publicized spectacle going on for a year or two in the United States, and the Meese Commission finally comes out with a report that was widely reported to have concluded that pornography causes harm. Actually, it didn't. If you read through this whole two-volume collection of testimony and reports and descriptions of pornographic films, what it basically says is we think there is moral harm. They don't claim to have identified any cause and effect relationship between pornography and bad acts, with the exception of violent pornography. But they say all pornography is morally offensive and it causes moral harm to society, and it's especially a bad influence on children.
Two concerns emerged during this time in relation to pornography. One was the impact of violent pornography, and the other was how to protect children from the rapidly increasing number of pornographic videos and websites.
Well, the number is the greatest thing, because the internet makes available just about any kind of pornographic expression, just about any kind of image, any kind of sound that you care to reproduce. I think what the internet has done more significantly, however, is that it has fetishized certain kinds of images and forms of expression. That is, in the past, pornographers never knew exactly what their audiences wanted. And sexuality, of course, and stimulation are really much more complicated things than we know. Many people are entirely unresponsive to the run-of-the-mill pornographic images that they are exposed to. But if they suddenly see a woman who conforms to their particular template of desire, say she's red-haired and large-busted and has large hips and wears particular kinds of outfits, then their interest is suddenly aroused. And what the internet makes possible is this kind of niche marketing.
As well as allowing more people to consume pornography online, the internet has also created a new genre of adult pornography.
The internet's had an astounding impact. You know, on one hand, it's brought pornography into the domestic space, which means that you certainly get a lot more women consuming it in younger age groups. There's good evidence of that. About a quarter of pornography consumers are women. You get couples consuming it. Obviously, it also exposes children far more to the potential risk of encountering pornography. The other side that's really interesting is it's opened up a whole realm of amateur porn. And in fact, the vast majority of pornography produced in Australia is made by ordinary people in their homes of all ages, shapes and sizes. And these people exchange it for free, and they basically do it because they're exhibitionists and it's part of their sex lives.
A more sinister development in online pornography has been the emergence of child pornography.
But I recall looking at some of the images of what would be called child pornography that existed in the 40s and the 50s. And almost invariably, the pictures were focused on children who were depicted simply as children. That is, they were girls and boys in communion dresses, for example, or girls and boys simply caught unawares. They were not particularly sexualized or eroticized for the viewer, but somehow they were sufficient and they had been seized when pedophiles themselves had been arrested. That particular impulse, the fixation on children, a fascination that we really don't understand very well, has developed since largely because of the available media, I think, into something that is much uglier and something that we find even more reprehensible, and that is exploiting children by putting them into sexual context, by depicting them in intercourse, for example, with adults.
It's the emergence of these kinds of images that has shaped contemporary government responses to pornography.
Well, here in the U.S., we've had a couple of federal laws passed by the U.S. Congress and numerous state laws passed by one or more of the 50 states trying to control pornography on the Internet. The first two laws passed by Congress have both been declared unconstitutional in violation of the First Amendment. The first one, in 1996, had a very broad definition of what was prohibited. It went well beyond obscenity and basically it made any indecent communication criminal on the Internet if it could be accessed by a minor, which ironically meant pretty much anything on the Internet except porn sites that had some kind of adult ID requirement. And ultimately the Supreme Court said it's much too broad. So that law is struck down, and Congress comes right back with a second Internet censorship law, again, a criminal prohibition. And both of these laws had pretty broad prohibition and then what were called good faith defenses. So in order to get around the now well-established legal principle that you can't reduce the adult population to reading and viewing only what is fit for children, the laws broadly prohibit anything that is considered unfit for children and then have these good faith defenses. If you have a website with, for example, explicit sex education material, all you have to do is put it behind some kind of screen and contract with some credit card company or some adult ID verification company to make sure that only adults can get in. Even before Australia got the idea to mandate that ISPs have filtration systems, the United States Congress passed a third Internet censorship law. And what Congress did was said all schools and libraries in the United States that receive any of a number of different kinds of federal aid for their computers, for their Internet connection. And a condition of this federal aid was now going to be you had to have Internet filters that block three categories of material, basically. Obscene, something called harmful to minors, which is basically a version of obscenity, and child pornography.
Here in Australia, the government's trial of mandatory internet filtering technology is due to begin in the next month. Despite opposition from some of the major internet service providers, including Telstra, which has declined to take part in the trial. And that's Rear Vision for this week. Our guests on the program today were Marjorie Hines, author of Not in Front of the Children, Indecency, Censorship and the Innocence of Youth, and Professor Joseph Slade, author of the 3-volume reference guide, Pornography and Sexual Representation, and Catherine Lumby, co-author of The Porn Report. Our sound engineer was Jenny Parsonage, and archival material came from ABC Archives. I'm Jane Shields. Join us again next week for Rear Vision on ABC Radio National.
This week on The Law Report, Victoria's Mental Health Review Board. It reviews decisions to forcibly hospitalise and forcibly treat those who lack insight into their mental illness. But a new report suggests it's the board that lacks insight and it should consider dumping the psychiatrist member from its panel. Who's wagging the finger at the doctors? Why, the lawyers, of course. That's on The Law Report with me, Damien Carrick, and you can download the program from the Radio National website.